This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Yemen's Amsterdam movement warns Saudi Arabia of painful response if Riyadh does not stop its aggression on Yemen. Over 250 Palestinian protesters are injured in an Israeli attack on a village in north of the occupied West Bank. And France registers a record high of over 104,000 COVID infections as it struggles to contain the rapid spread of the Omicron variant. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Saudi warplanes have conducted fresh airstrikes on Yemen, this time targeting the country's capital, Sana'a. Local media says at least three airstrikes were carried out against a residential area. Attacks left a number of homes damaged, but no casualties have yet been reported. And this comes after the Yemeni army said it struck vital and sensitive Saudi targets in retaliation for the kingdom's escalating aggression against its southern neighbor. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says positions in the port city of Jizan were targeted with three state-of-the-art precision-guided missiles. He warned of more, quote, painful operations as long as Saudi Arabia continues its atrocities against Yemen. Riyadh and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in early 2015, killing hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians, and causing a dire humanitarian situation in the country. Our Sana'a correspondent Abdulatif Al-Washali has been following the latest developments in Yemen. Here's his update just a bit earlier.
The Saudi warplanes again targeted another residential early area called the Libyan neighborhood. A number of houses were destroyed by the airstrikes, and the military experts say that the Saudi-led coalition is using a specific type of bombs that causes fires. Whatever it's dropped, the fires are there, and the firefighters are on the way to the place that was targeted. The Saudi warplanes, or the Saudi coalition, has also threatened to target the Az-Zubayri Street in the capital Sana'a, which is a very crowded area. I live there, and they said that they will target this area again today, and they know that it is very crowded and residential area, so they don't have the right to bomb such a place, such area, which is a residential area. I took my family to a farther place, to a few miles away from the airstrikes. They are targeting civilians. They are killing Yemeni people, and unfortunately, the international community remain silent to the Saudi crimes that are being committed on daily basis.
Now over 250 Palestinian protesters are injured in a fresh Israeli attack on a village of Birka in the occupied West Bank province of Nablus. Israeli soldiers fired live bullets, rubber-coated rounds, stun grenades, and tear gas to disperse Palestinian protesters. Now the demonstrators were infuriated by a shutdown of the entrance to their village. Move came as the Israeli army intensified its presence on the Nablus-Jenin Road to secure dozens of busloads packed with Israeli settlers. In recent days, the settlers have been protected by the army, have stormed the homes of Palestinian citizens on the outskirts of Birka. Earlier, we were joined by our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Candia, who gave us the latest on Israel's fresh attacks on the West Bank village of Birka. Here she is.
Today, Palestinians had been gathering in the village of Birka in order to prevent any raids by the Israeli settlers, not only to the illegal settlement of Homish that already was built on the village, on the lands of the village of Birka, but also to prevent the settlers' raids to the village of Birka and the nearby villages. The Israeli military issued an order to prevent, or at least to not allow the settlers to arrive to the Homish settlement in order not to be clashing with the Palestinians there. However, Palestinians there are saying they will continue to protest in order to protect their lands and in order to prevent any more seizure of their lands, knowing that the Israeli military would be cutting off the roads, preventing Palestinians to arrive to the village of Burqa and the other villages there. However, they would continue protesting regardless of the measures that will be taken by the Israeli military and regardless of the aggression and the violence that could take place by the settlers themselves.
In Sudan, security forces clashed with protesters demonstrating against the October military coup. Riot police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse protesters. That after thousands of demonstrators converged on the presidential palace in the capital to express anger and demand civilian rule. A number of protesters were injured. A similar event was also held in Madani, a town south of Khartoum. Authorities cut the internet and telephone lines. African nations witnessed protests since the military takeover on the 25th of October and the arrest of civilian leaders. Rallies are staged despite a reinstatement of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who was ousted in the coup. Earlier, we spoke to our Khartoum correspondent Mohamed Fazari for more details about the protests. He said Sudanese protesters are calling for the restoration of their civilian government.
The Sudanese took it to the street of Khartoum, to the capital city and other cities, for the second month for protesting against the coup and the army takeover of 25th of October. So they are rejecting even the coup and the deal that time between General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the Supreme Council leader, and Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. So early morning, the Sudanese security forces blocked all the roads that and bridges lead to the Khartoum and other cities, and before the police used excessive forces and using tear gas to disperse thousands of protesters. Protesters retreat their slogan that no negotiation, no compromise, no power sharing, and add new three no's. They add four no's, which is no legitimacy, in referring to the coup of 25th October. So they insist to continue with the strong determination till the downfall of the coup regime and to restore the full civilian government.
In northeast Somalia, thousands of people have been forced to leave their homes amid soaring clashes between two rival factions of the security forces. A local official said that most people were leaving after warring sides resorted to heavy machine guns and mortars in the city of Bosaso. Commercial capital of the semi-autonomous state of Puntland has been rocked by heavy clashes in recent days. Now, on Thursday, the United Nations Humanitarian Agency voiced concern over the escalation of violence there. It said more than half of the city's population has left their homes in search of safety. Puntland is one of five semi-autonomous states in the restive Horn of Africa nation. In other news, the Omicron variant of the coronavirus is breaking new records in Europe. France has logged over 100,000 new daily cases of the virus, its highest daily tally since the start of the pandemic. Over 3,200 patients are in intensive care units throughout French hospitals. Neighboring Italy is also seeing a record in new infections for a third straight day, registering more than 54,000 cases. Omicron accounts for 6 out of 10 coronavirus infections in Portugal. In England, authorities are racing against time to vaccinate as many people as possible as the caseload soars there. Now, the country has administered over 30 million jabs so far, but British Health Minister believes it's not enough. The new COVID variant Omicron is impacting almost everything, especially the year-end celebrations. Nearly 6,000 flights have been canceled worldwide and thousands delayed over the Christmas weekend. A website which tracks global flights says more than 2,600 flights were scrubbed around the world on Christmas Day. That includes more than 900 originating from or heading to U.S. airports. Over 4,000 delays were also reported on the same day. Airlines cancellations include Lufthansa, Delta Airlines, United Airlines, and JetBlue, with pilots and flight attendants calling in sick or having to quarantine after exposure to COVID. The Chinese airlines accounted for the highest number of cancellations, with China Eastern scrapping over 1,000 flights. After a long and drawn-out period of negotiations, UK finally left the European Union at the end of January 2020, ending its 47 years of membership. As part of the divorce package, the two sides agreed to a set of trade rules known as the Northern Ireland Protocol. Goods from the UK are checked at ports in Northern Ireland, which remains in the EU's single market, so trade can move freely across its land border with the Republic of Ireland. But nearly 2 years on, UK Brexit says that the UK government, that is, pardon, says that arrangement is not working. Now it wants a new deal and does not want the European Court of Justice to govern the protocol. The EU is offering to remove some customs checks, but it's also calling on the UK to reciprocate in other ways. Saipurza reports on how they got there.
It was supposed to ensure seamless trade between the UK and the EU following Brexit. But the Northern Ireland Protocol has become a problem itself. Or has it? Negotiated in 2019, the protocol was aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland, still in the EU's single market, and EU member Republic of Ireland. Instead, it's created a regulatory border in the Irish Sea, which acts as a de facto EU-UK frontier. Now, British goods entering Northern Ireland are subject to EU checks and customs regulations. While some have disliked the protocol from day one, others have found it beneficial.
From a business perspective, the Brexit and vaccination, the protocol has been a good thing for the people of the North of Ireland. Obviously, we have the best of both worlds. But if you listen to a small minority that is being platformed by the media, both in Britain and the North of Ireland here, you would think that the protocol was damaging business.
That small minority are elements in the loyalist or unionist community in Northern Ireland, people who wish their country to remain part of the UK. They feel they have been cut off from the mainland. Before becoming Prime Minister, Boris Johnson had told pro-UK parties that he didn't want to see Northern Ireland left abandoned by a border in the sea.
Now, I have to tell you, no British Conservative government could or should sign up to any such arrangement.
That assurance fell by the wayside. A sense of betrayal prevailed. Protests ensued. To the UK government, that meant changing the goalposts.
The protocol is not working. It's completely lost consent in one community in Northern Ireland. It's not doing the thing it was set up to do, protect the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. In fact, it's doing the opposite.
A fact only admitted after the UK left the EU. The European Union rejected any renegotiation of the deal. Some experts believe the government must have known about the problems ahead from day one of Brexit, calling into question the UK's credibility as an international trading partner.
The UK has absolutely no credibility internationally. We've seen that its two biggest partners in the world, the EU and the American government, have made statements on how they feel about the UK renegotiating international treaties. So even to make any kind of statement that the UK have any integrity on the international stage now is laughable. The UK have no credibility since the Tory government and Brexit.
Another bone of contention, the UK government's demand to remove the EU's legal oversight role, part of the Northern Ireland Protocol, saying as long as the role of the European Court of Justice continues, the protocol will never survive. But in early December, Prime Minister Johnson's Conservative government reluctantly dropped that demand, at a time when it would appear the majority of people in Northern Ireland want an end to the standoff.
Whether they be Irish unionists or Irish nationalists, of course, the Tories have always used unionists for the old divide and conquer strategy here in the North of Ireland. So I think it's just sheer incompetence and, of course, the arrogance in it.
Things took a turn for the worse for the UK Prime Minister with the December 18 high-profile resignation of his chief Brexit negotiator, David Frost, who was replaced less than 24 hours later by Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, who openly backed remaining in the EU in 2016. She's now tasked with resolving her country's differences with the EU, what nearly 2 years of negotiations by her predecessor failed to do.
The UK blames the EU for being inflexible and worrying too much about the so-called integrity of their single market. And Brussels blames London for trying to scrap an international treaty that it signed nearly 2 years ago. Experts say there is no obvious way out of the ongoing stalemate, meaning that Brexit is not exactly done yet. Saeed Purizap, London.
Iran has hosted the 22nd edition of the International Telecom Exhibition. Annual event brings together ICT firms and startups to present their products and services. Yusuf Jalali gave it a visit.
Telecom is a major ICT exhibition in Iran that brings together both private and state actors in information and communication technology to showcase their products and services. After a limited edition last year due to the coronavirus pandemic, the annual event has this year opened its doors to all domestic companies to participate.
Our company produces smart systems that work based on the Internet of Things, and recently we produced a smart assistant for animal farming, which helps the farmer monitor the health of livestock and their latest needs.
In the past 2 years, due to the coronavirus pandemic and the growing trend toward remote learning, we thought it would be a good idea to produce tablets for students to easily follow up on their online education. We are also active in producing apps for a range of uses with a focus on telemedicine.
When it comes to ICT, any advancement affects all other industries. The emergence of the 5G network, for example, was a game changer for surgical operations, allowing telesurgeries to be conducted seamlessly and with higher precision. Like this newly unveiled Iranian-made robotic surgeon called Sina, which uses 5G to allow a remote surgery to be carried out.
Sina's surgery system has two main subsystems: a master robotic console at the surgeon's side and a slave robotic system at patient's side, which are connected through a 5G wireless network. So any movement of my hands here are transferred to the slave robotic arms, and it is as if the surgeon is present beside the patient.
For sanctions hit Iran, it's not an easy task to catch up with modern trends in the ICT. However, the government says it has tripled its allocated budget for the ICT this year to encourage local firms to push the industry forward and promote what it refers to as digital economy.
The increase in the allocated budget is a result of the government's special attention to the ICT sector. We are planning to promote electronic government and move away from traditional market toward online market. All this needs a strong infrastructure which the government needs to build.
The government says it is also trying to capitalize on venture capital funds and accelerators to move the ICT sector forward. In recent years, an increasing number of sponsoring firms have turned to this area to support innovative ideas and lead them to the market, the results of which remain to be seen in the years to come.
The ICT sector in Iran is among the hardest hit by U.S. sanctions, but the country says it views any challenge as an opportunity. Officials say this expo gives a small picture of how Iran's ICT has thrived under pressure and tried to keep abreast of the fast-growing trend in the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Christians in the occupied Palestinian territories face the threat of extinction from radical Israeli groups. Church leaders have warned in a startling message in the run-up to Christmas. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Electronic Intifada. This article is titled, Palestinian Christians Face Threat of Extinction from Radical Israeli Groups. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Christians in the occupied Palestinian territories face the threat of extinction from radical Israeli groups. Church leaders have warned in a startling message in the run-up to Christmas. They have called for help from the worldwide Christian community of 2.3 billion people. In recent years, the lives of many Christians have been made unbearable by radical local groups with extremist ideologies, said Francisco Patton, the Catholic Church's custos of the Holy Land. Writing in the Daily Telegraph, he warned of the threat from Israeli extremists. Despite 2,000 years of faithful service, our presence is precarious and our future is at risk. Patton is also the guardian of the Christian religious sites in the Holy Land. He pointed out, where once we numbered 20% of the population of Al-Quds, today, the Christian community counts for less than 2%. Prior to the creation of the fake regime of Israel in 1948, Palestinian Christians were the second largest religious community, making up more than 11% of the total population. The waves of ethnic cleansing, which the Palestinians call the Nakba or catastrophe, have reduced their number to its present extinction level. The Zionist regime's violent capture, illegal annexation, and military occupation of Al-Quds has accelerated the flight of Palestinian Christians from their country. Human rights groups have described the Zionist regime's rule over the territory as a form of apartheid, under which Christian Palestinians are also treated like second- and third-class citizens. Patton explained that the lives of Christians have been made unbearable because radical Jewish groups seek to free the old city of Al-Quds from its Christian presence, even the Christian quarter. The targeting of Palestinian Christians has increased at an alarming rate. In the last years, we suffered because of the desecration of our holy sites, the vandalization of our churches, offenses against our priests, monks, and worshippers, he said. The frequency of these hate crimes leaves families and communities who lived here for generations feeling unwelcome in their own homes. Patton said that the radical Israeli groups are waging a war of attrition against a community before urging the global Christian community to aid Palestinian Christians facing the threat of extinction. A similar message was delivered by Bishop of Canterbury Justin Welby in an article for The Times co-authored with the Anglican Bishop of Al-Quds Hossam Naum. In remarks that should ring alarm bells across the Christian world, the two leaders said that when you speak to Palestinian Christians in Al-Quds today, you will often hear them saying, in 15 years' time, there will be none of us left. Calling for followers to pray for the Christians being driven from the Holy Land, will be a Nome warned that in the birthplace of the church, worshippers are dwindling in the face of intimidation and discrimination by Zionists. Details of a joint statement by church leaders were mentioned in a Times piece, including the sustained attacks by fringe radical groups against Christians and countless physical and verbal assaults against priests and other clergy and Christian churches. The bishops added that the growth of Israeli settler communities and travel restrictions brought about by the West Bank separation wall have deepened the isolation of Christian villages and curtailed economic and social possibilities. The remarks by the church leaders triggered a backlash from the Board of Deputies of British Jews, which has called for a meeting with the Bishop of Canterbury to discuss what they describe as deeply troubling passages in the Times article.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You're listening to I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sayyid Murtaza, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Thank you very much for inviting.
Thank you very much again for accepting my invitation to the program Viewpoints. Today we want to talk about the personality of Jesus Christ or Isa ibn Maryam, Hazrat Masih. Also, these are the titles that are used for Prophet of Allah. And also Lady Mary or Hazrat Maryam, as pictured in the religion of Islam and the Quran, and the respect that Islam had for these two very dear personalities. Sayyid Murtaza, let's start with you, brother, how the religion of Islam looked at the very personality of Hazrat Masih.
Thank you very much. You know, Jesus, an English name.
Yes.
And Mary, both are very special characters, and they have a special status, actually, in the religion of Islam, because these two characters have been compared to many other, you know, characters around the world, and their names have been many times mentioned and brought in the Book of Islam, Quran. So when Islam is bringing these two names and is quoting on them and is talking about their lifestyles, and is providing the whole humanity some information how these people were faithful to God. So it shows that the religion of Islam is not only against Jesus and Mary, but also is supporting them and is asking people to respect them highly.
Yes.
So this is a picture that Islam draws of these two great personalities. Jesus is the prophet to God.
Yes.
And God revealed even a book, Gospel, to Jesus.
Yes.
So it shows that Jesus is one of the descendants of Abraham.
Yes.
So it shows that the prophet of Islam and Jesus both have their, you know, backgrounds the same.
Yes.
So it shows that Islam has compared Jesus and Mary with many other personalities, and the great respect has been given to them.
That's right. But Sayyid Mohsen, the look that even some of the Christian communities has at their own prophets and their books is very much different from what the religion of Islam has. And this makes a question that who knows better its religion? You know, the followers of the same religion or the followers of the religion that comes you know, so many years after that? What's your answer to that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, when we talk about the Islam, Islam is not a separate religion from what Jesus Christ brought for the people of that time. We should bear in mind that the Judaism or Christianity, this word Christianity or Judaism,
yes,
this is a word which was made by people themselves, and not this name wasn't put by the prophets over the people. For example, Jesus did not said like whoever will follow me or whoever I'm preaching, they are Christians.
Okay.
This deviation and the names were put by the people themselves.
Yes.
Whereas in the Quran, Allah says Bani Israel.
Okay.
Okay. There's no Judaism. And obviously, when we see this, like the people who later put a specific name for themselves because they're attaching themselves to someone. So they got the name of Christianity and the Judaism. When we talk about the Islam, we have many verses in the Quran, and there are many proofs in the Quran, the verses that say, like, all the prophets who came, they all brought one thing, and that was Islam itself. Means submitting to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Islam in its literal meaning, submitting. And Muslim also means, or the Muslim, when we say Muslim, it means the one who submits.
Yes.
So all the prophets, they asked their people to submit to one God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
And that was the main theme of every single prophet. So when we say, like, do we know more? Does Islam knows more, or the people who are following? We should also look at the history that the gospel which brother has referred to, when it was written. It was written later, like after like 400 years
okay.
of Jesus. Like,
you mean this is not the same text that was revealed?
No, it wasn't the same text which was said by the Jesus. It okay. was written 400 years after that.
Okay.
And the Old Testament that we have, it was written 1,000 years after the Moses.
Okay.
So we need to look at the historical aspect as well. Whereas the Quran, when we're talking about the Quran itself, it was written at the time of the prophet, and he dictated the verses which used to reveal.
Okay.
So I don't think this is a right question, like if we want to say, or it is not right to say, okay. like the Muslims do not know about the Jesus because they are not the follower. We are the hard follower of Jesus and Moses
yes.
and Abraham as well, because yes. they are our prophets. And to become a Muslim must believe in 124,000 prophets
okay.
from which there is a Jesus and there is Moses. And in the Quran, we can yes. see many times Allah has said, Isa ibn Maryam. He refers yes. to the Jesus, son of Mary.
That's right.
And also to the prophet Abraham and the Moses. And we know that the Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, they all are the Abrahamic religions. So when the main person who's like, we okay. call ourselves Abrahamic, so we all refer back to Ibrahim alayhi salam.
And the monotheistic wonder religions
yes.
all across the world. But say, Murtaza, you know, the question is now, we must have enough knowledge about the previous religions too, you know, as a Muslim. And this is when maybe some of the Muslims around the world does not have enough knowledge about their own religions and the details around. And I think this gives us a kind of authenticity about how the religions were revealed to the prophets of Allah during the history, and how the religion of Islam could complete the previous versions of the religions, isn't so?
You know, historically talking, everyone needs actually to learn a lesson from history. And when it comes to speaking about religions and the background of religions, and the religions that were actually before and after one another. So let's look at Jesus Christ and his mother Mary in the Book of Islam. And we know that the Book of Islam, Quran specifically, has put a great emphasis on Jesus' presence in society and Mary in society as well. So, you know, these two acted strongly like messengers, and they actually received messages from God, and then it was disseminated and distributed among people. So the same two roles have been, you know, followed and have been taken by Jesus Christ and his mother. So it shows a footstep to all of us that we need to follow in their footsteps,
yes.
Like we Muslims must follow in footsteps of our prophets and all our infallible imams.
That's right.
So it shows to all of us that what has been preached, it must be practiced.
That's right.
So unfortunately, we don't have this. In Christianity, unfortunately, we have a lot of rules that most of them have been overlooked by Christians.
Yes.
And in Judaism, we have the same thing, because I had my personal studies related to these factors.
Okay.
We have commonalities, we have similarities between religions, but unfortunately, those rules, the very effective rules, have been overlooked by the followers. And it shows that Islam as a religion has a better understanding, has a better description of the role of Jesus
right.
Christ
okay.
and his mother.
Right.
So it shows that people need to learn a very good lesson from
that's
the
right.
history
right.
and look at the picture how Islam
okay.
actually created
right.
of Jesus Christ and his mother.
That's right. But Sayyid Mohsen, what was the main reason of revealing such ayahs to the Prophet of Islam in Arab Peninsula about the previous prophets, especially Prophet Masih, you know, Isa ibn Maryam, Jesus Christ, and Lady Mary? This is really a great question to be asked, you know, that what was the main reason? I mean, what is the use? For example, the ignorant Arabs, the Jahiliyyah Arab on that time, being familiar with the previous prophets, was there any intention behind that?
Well, first of all, let me just make clear that when we talk about the Arabs, the way you said Jahil or ignorant.
Sorry, no, at the time of Jahiliyyah, sorry.
Even when we use the word Jahiliyyah,
yes.
that does not mean they were ignorant. You know, they had the best poets, and when they used to hear a poem from someone, they used to memorize it at the spot.
Okay.
So
they
were
memories.
Intelligent at
yes.
that time. The Jahalat is something else. The Jahalat we refer because they were worshipping idols.
Okay.
They were not worshipping the God and the religions, the Abrahamic religions. That's why, you know, they were in the Jahalat, in the darkness. This Jahalat means darkness, not the ignorance.
Okay.
That's the first thing.
Okay.
The second thing is, when we look at the prophets, we see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent 124,000 prophets. But we don't see their names in the Quran. Not all of them.
Yes.
The answer is, if the Quran was the book of history, then you would find all the names with their date of birth, I don't know, date of demise, and the place where they were. Whereas the Quran is the book of guidance. It has revealed to give guidance and give lesson to the people, to take people towards the right path. Therefore, those prophets who are mentioned in the Quran, number one, they are Ulul Azm. Like all the Ulul Azm, like the, you can say, the supreme prophets. There are six of them. But we have like Prophet Nuh, Prophet Abraham, Prophet Musa, Prophet Jesus, Prophet Muhammad, and Prophet Adam, alayhi salam, the first prophet. So these prophets, six prophets, they're Ulul Azm, basically. Or according to some, they don't count Prophet Adam, alayhi salam, then we have five, plus Prophet Adam.
Five accounts, right, too.
All these prophets are mentioned,
yes.
Number one. Number two, the rest of the prophets, like Prophet Khizr and other prophets, why they're discussed in the Quran? Because this book is book of guidance. So Allah needs to give guidance. Therefore, these prophets who are mentioned, all of them, they were the, we can say, like, they have all those characters which the rest of the prophets from 124,000 prophets had. And it was, we can say, they have it collectively in themselves. And all the characters which all the prophets from Adam alayhi salam till Jesus had, all of them were in the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So we have these narrations and these things. So why the Jesus has been discussed in the Quran? It's because, number one, the followers of that religion, Christianity, are still in the world. They were at that time, at the time of the Prophet. Similarly, the story of the Musa alayhi salam of Bani Israel, it is also mentioned. The others as well.
That's right.
The polytheists, the stories of the polytheists are also mentioned.
Okay.
Like mushrikeen, the idol
yes.
worshippers, and all those. So basically, it's because we have many people who are still the followers of such prophets,
yes.
those prophets, number one. Number two, because these prophets, the characteristics of these prophets, this were in a way that they have become a role model, not for the people of their time, but for the people even
yes.
after them. And because there's many discussions, especially, in the Christianity, they believe that the Jesus is Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
This is what they believe.
Trinity.
Yeah, Trinity.
Yes.
They believe that Jesus is Son of God. On the other hand, in the Quran, we have seen, like in the history as well, that Mubahila has happened between the Muslims and the Christians.
Christians, that's true.
The main base was that there were some Christians who came from Najran to Medina to see what this prophet, new prophet is saying. And when they came there, they said to the prophet that we believe in Jesus, Son of God. And the Prophet Muhammad said, I believe in Jesus, Prophet of God. Mm-hmm. And they said, you are basically reducing the status of the Jesus
yes.
from being son to the Prophet. And you made him a servant of God. He's not the servant, he's the son of God.
Okay.
And then Prophet argued, Prophet said, what do you believe? What is your belief about the Adam alayhi salam? They said, he was the servant of God. Then the Prophet said, Adam neither had the father nor mother. So he should enjoy that status of being the son of God, whereas Jesus had the mother at least. So these were the arguments. So yes. why Jesus is there? Because even in the Quran we have the verse that Jesus has said, O Allah, I never said them that I'm your son. I'm your prophet and you need to judge between us on the day of judgment.
Okay.
So the other reason, the second reason is because of the many followers of such religions, therefore it is necessary to talk about such prophets so that these people can come back to the right path.
That's right.
And the deviation which they had from the right religion,
yes.
they should basically refer back. And that's why the Quran is talking about the Jesus alayhi salam, the Virgin Mary, the role of Gabriel as yes. an angel of yes. revelation, and the other prophets as well.
That's all right. And really, there must be a lesson in all these life accounts of the previous prophets in the Holy Quran for not only the Muslims, but also, you know, the people of other generations who want to be familiar with their own, historical account of the life of the prophets and the great personalities like Lady Mary. And you know, Lady Mary, you know, has really a special status. She's believed by the Muslims to be among the outstanding role models for the ladies all around the world, isn't it, Sayyid Mirza?
Of course, yes. Role models and these great characters must have something to teach us. And if we can't find a lesson to learn from them, I don't think we can call them role models.
Yes.
And the Book of Islam is full of stories about these great characters. Jesus Christ himself and his mother, Lady Mary, both of these two names have been mentioned many times. Specifically, Lady Mary, I think her name has been mentioned over 34, 35 times. And it shows her great status in the Book of Islam. So these two characters, not only for Christians, but also for all humanity, have something to deliver. So in today's world, I think the followers of Islam and the followers of all religions must look into the private, social, and personal lifestyles of these two characters, because certainly we will find a lot of merits and advantages that we can pick up and use them in our own life. So I don't think it is right and correct to say that Muslims, for example, should not celebrate the birthday of Jesus Christ.
Okay.
So it doesn't show that Muslims are following the Christianity. It
yes.
shows that they show their great respect
that's right.
To the birth of Jesus Christ.
Okay.
So today is the Jesus birthday. So
yeah, December 25th,
Muslims,
that's right.
So all Muslims must respect.
Yes.
And if they celebrate, I don't think it's wrong.
Yes.
It's not because of the Christianity. It's
yes.
because of the Holy Prophet,
yes.
that his name has been directly
yes.
mentioned many times in the Book of Islam.
That's
so
right.
there is a lesson for us
yes.
that we have to follow all these religions,
yes.
all these prophets, and respect them as much as we can.
As we could see in the Islamic Republic of Iran, there are so many Christians living. And on these days, from December 25th to January 1st, they are celebrating the celebration in their own churches in Tehran, you know, in Yazd, in Shiraz, and in different places in Isfahan, you know, all around the Islamic Republic of Iran, shows how much the also religious minorities like Christianity are respected in an Islamic land, the Shia Islamic land like Iran. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mirza and Sayyid Mohsen, for your presence in the program. And again, congratulations on the birthday anniversary of Isa ibn Maryam, Prophet Jesus Christ. And also congratulations to all our Christian brothers and sisters all around the world. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This was Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com for the Stashi and Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
عيسى بن مريم عليهما السلام بشر أتباعه بنبي يأتي من بعده اسمه أحمد، وأحمد هو محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم.
عيسى نبي الله.
وصفوا المحمد بالقبيح قد كان أولى أن تقولوا كالمسيح من كان يتبع المسيح يقول ما قد قاله عيسى بأحمد من مدينة.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Armed drones have become a staple of modern American warfare, placing operators at a historically unprecedented remove from danger. At the same time, they have exposed those targeted, whether combatants or civilians, to a form of violence that they can neither defend themselves against nor surrender to. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Murtaza Hussein, journalist. This article is published under the heading Psychological Tools and Moral Hazards of Drone Warfare. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. On what would be the last day of his life, Zimari Ahmadi, an employee of a U.S.-based NGO, was being watched by a remote crew piloting a Predator drone above the skies of Kabul, Afghanistan. As Ahmadi went about his work running a series of errands across the city, the drone operators, though they did not know his identity, were making plans to kill him. A series of innocuous actions like Ahmadi loading water containers into his car were interpreted in the minds of the operators watching as sinister preparations for a suicide bomb attack. After surveilling Ahmadi for several hours, the drone operators issued a death sentence, firing a hellfire missile at his car as he drove up to his home just as three children were rushing out to greet him. A total of 10 people, all civilians, were killed in the attack that the U.S. military had initially insisted had targeted a terrorist working with the Daesh. The deaths of Ahmadi and his family members were unique in the level of public attention they received. It was sadly unremarkable, though, in the context of the larger U.S. drone war that has been waged over the past 20 years. Armed drones have become a staple of modern American warfare, placing operators at a historically unprecedented remove from danger. At the same time, they have exposed those targeted, whether combatants or civilians, to a form of violence that they can neither defend themselves against nor surrender to. Freed from the traditional reciprocity of war in which both sides put their lives on the line, drone operators have become more like judicial executioners, putting people on trial on the other side of the planet without due process and meting out death sentences by remote control. The U.S. pioneered this style of warfare, but is no longer alone in using what is technically called unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs. Other countries, including U.S. rivals, are ramping up their own drone programs, signaling that this style of killing at great distance is likely to become a defining feature of war in the 21st century. Other drone operators describe experiencing physiological distress during their missions, as well as brief bursts of adrenaline following successful shots that supported friendly ground forces engaged in active combat. When they were asked to describe their worst day on the job, many of their responses dealt with what drone crews saw in the aftermath of certain strikes. One sensor operator on a drone described their worst day to Phelps this way: watching the son of the person I just obliterated with a Hellfire missile pick up the pieces of his father. It wasn't the act of killing I focused on. It was watching the boy's face and interactions with the rest of his family that continue to haunt me, unquote. In countries like Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, the U.S. has carried out thousands of strikes in the absence of a meaningful U.S. ground presence. The people being killed on the ground in these strikes usually do not and indeed cannot pose any conceivable threat to Americans. Rennie argues, with reference to philosophical traditions like just war theory, that this makes even many purportedly legitimate drone targets, particularly the low-level rural foreign fighters who bear the brunt of drone program, little different from civilians. The concept of war as a legal and morally regulated activity was historically built on an assumption of mutual risk and danger among those taking part. That dynamic simply no longer exists when one side is fighting only with robots from the other side of the planet. While prior technological advances may have reduced the structural threat between combatants, drone warfare is the first time that one side has made themselves absolutely immune to violence. Rettig writes, UAV-exclusive violence marks a fundamental shift in the nature of hostilities from an adversarial contention to something more closely approximating judicial sanction. One outcome of this shift has been dehumanization of those targeted by the United States. What emerges in place of war as a situation of mutual risk is simply an unending series of executions carried out from the skies. The task of the people carrying out many strikes is less about overcoming an enemy in battle than issuing moral judgments and death sentences against individuals who pose no conceivable threat to the U.S. and whose customs, circumstances, and even identities are often unknown to them. To use a chilling metaphor, Rennick argues that killing through drone strikes outside of active combat situations is less like war, as traditionally defined and more, like a creative process of disinfection. In cases where drones are targeting high-level terrorists who are directly planning attacks against the U.S. or where they're supporting friendly ground forces in combat, the strikes are more justifiable according to traditional moral schema. These are not often the circumstances of drone strikes. Thousands of strikes have taken place outside of active combat zones over the years or have targeted low-level fighters or even unarmed individuals who pose no direct threat to U.S. forces or even civilians. An investigative report recently published by the military-focused news site Connecting Vets, including leaked footage of many strikes, outlined the extent to which U.S. military commanders became obsessed with killing low-level suspected Taliban members in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, during a 2019 drone campaign. After initially trying to cover up the killings of Zimari Ahmadi and his family in Kabul, the Pentagon subsequently backtracked following a stream of news reports disproving their narrative about killing ISIS terrorists. Though it was forced to admit responsibility, the military has said that no disciplinary action would be taken against anyone involved in the attack that took the lives of 10 members of an innocent family. If drone warfare, whether autonomous or not, is to have any moral component at all, it must include some accountability for the innocent people regularly killed in strikes like the one that ended the life of Zimari Ahmadi. Periodic apologies aside, moral responsibility toward the tens of thousands killed, maimed, or deprived of their loved ones over the past 20 years has been, in short, evidence. Amal Ahmadi, Zimari's brother, told reporters in the aftermath of the drone strike, "That is not enough for us to say sorry. The United States of America can see from everywhere. They can see that there were innocent children near the car and in the car. Whoever did this should be punished. It is not right."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.